Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another Quarantine Stream edition of the Cinema Clash. I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net, joined ever remotely by Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com. Another week gone by, Charlie. What's new?
Is a year of RIPs, Hannah, and they continued again this week. Rest in peace, Ennio Morricone, who I consider to be the 20th century's greatest film composer. I know a lot of people out there will name, oh, what about John Williams? What about blah, blah, blah? No, Ennio Morricone, even if you do not know his name, you know his music. His most famous being that little bit I just played from The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, but everyone has their own favorite Morricone. My personally one is Once Upon a Time in America. I love Cinema Paradiso and The Untouchables. I was just listening to The Untouchables earlier today, and I realized that score is better than the film, Hannah.
I think that was the case. I did read that most people agreed that his music elevated every film that he scored. So he definitely did quite a bit. I got to admit, though, the only music that I really was completely familiar with, like when I heard that he had died, was those bars you just played from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's the one that I'm most aware of. So then it sort of becomes de facto my favorite, because the other films that you mentioned, while I know he's got quite the repertoire, I would not have been able to identify him as the composer of those particular films. But hey, that's me, because you're the one who knows that stuff more than I do. But well, you know who else we lost?
You saw him win an Oscar just a few years ago for The Hateful Eight. He became Tarantino's film composer, and he won for The Hateful Eight. And, you know, a plug for, if you want to listen to a little bit more Ennio, you know, Edgar Wright, the director of Shaun of the Dead, Baby Driver, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, he created a wonderful, comprehensive Spotify playlist, which has been on repeat when I wash the dishes at night and other times, of his favorite Ennio. And it's just a perfect, introduction for some, reminder for others. Go find Edgar Wright's Spotify playlist.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I will listen. And I did click through when a bunch of people were posting little snippets of sound. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember. Okay, that's good. Yeah, that's good too. So absolutely, the maestro. A legend, 91 years old, good on him, and definitely a loss to the film world. Another loss, though, to the film world, but probably just as much or more so the TV world and the radio world, was Carl Reiner this week, and he lived to be 98. He had quite a full life, but you know, he's remembered most in recent history in film, really, for his brief yet very funny appearances in Ocean's 11 and 12 and 13. So a true legend in comedy. So I just want him to get his due as well.
You know, I missed the things, the acts, the bits that made Carl Reiner this legend. Yes, I've seen some clips of him with Mel Brooks, and it's very funny, but I wasn't there when it happened. I don't get it. I know Carl Reiner as the director of funny Steve Martin movies like The Jerk. And yeah, I remember him from the remake of the Ocean's 11 franchise. So yeah, I'm too young to have this connection to Carl Reiner, but both Ennio and Carl, they were not old Hollywood, but they were certainly old guard, Hannah. They were old guard.
But I'm bumped. Where is that going, Charlie?
I apologize to our podcast listening audience for that, but it was so horrible I actually had to set it up that way. We're talking about the biggest film this week is from Netflix, and it's called The Old Guard, starring Charlize Theron, as we've seen her before. We've seen her in Atomic Blonde. We've seen her in Mad Max, Fury Road, and she's back butt-kicking again, but this time she's immortal. She's an immortal mercenary. We don't know how old she is, but she is old, and she's fighting to keep her small band of immortals secret, and B, she's trying to break in a newbie. I love the expansive premise. I love stories about immortals. They can go anywhere, even in time. They can meet anybody, be anywhere for any event. But the old guard felt saddled with such a cheap villain, and it became pretty stale to me in the second half. It didn't work for me, Hannah, in the second half. It had such a promising lead-in, though.
I still think it works overall. What makes it hard to track a little bit is that you don't quite know how to define what genre it's trying to be. It's sort of a superhero movie, but it's got these shades of supernatural and a romance and some sci-fi fantasy and a history lesson or two sort of built into there. And then on another front, it's quite like the Avengers. You know, you've got this close-knit, dysfunctional family of these random warriors who are constantly putting themselves in the line of fire to save humanity. You know, only this time they become the targets of what I agree is a pretty weak, evil plot. The villains to me were, especially there's a CEO of a big pharma, and his character seemed very cartoonish to me. But I just thought that it's got a lot of girl power. And so I did Charlize Theron and, I'm blanking on Kiki Layne. Kiki Layne, both of them really do have kick-ass performances, and they're fun to watch, and they are the real power of this movie. And so, you know, it was a setup. It's one of those types of movies that tries to do too much by way of introduction, because it's really trying to open the door to a franchise. Whether these characters catch on or not will sort of dictate whether or not there are more of these. The door's left open for sure. So I think I liked it more than you did. I didn't think it was a perfect movie by any stretch, but I enjoyed it. It was like 2 hours of just generally interesting, entertaining, easy to watch action, female-led film movie, and so, you know, it's a preposterous premise, but the characters themselves are actually quite relatable. So I think that's what saved it.
You relate a lot with a 6,000-year-old. speaking of girl power and female-led, what an interesting choice of director, Gina Prince Bythewood. I remember her from the year 2000. She did a movie called Love and Basketball, starring Omar Epps and Sanaa Lathan. That got passed around my college group of friends at the time. We all kind of just latched onto that film and liked it a lot. Kiki Layne, we remember her from Beale Street.
Mm-hmm. And if Beale Street could talk.
Mm-hmm. Her character got on my nerves. She's the newbie who dies and immediately becomes an immortal, and she doesn't like it. She doesn't want to be it, and she's not conforming with the group, and like, okay. It's based on comic books, graphic novels. The same guy adapted his own screenplay, but it just comes off so pedestrian. However, it was the Rotten Tomatoes users' most anticipated film of July. And that should tell you about July film, that The Old Guard was everyone's most anticipated film.
I can see that because you have Charlize Theron is just a good draw. And I'll tell you, you remember Gina Prince Bythewood from Love and Basketball, but I actually really enjoyed and sort of found that her 2014 chick flick Beyond the Lights, which had sort of was a drama, music, romance kind of chick flick, was actually quite good. So, you know, she's had to juggle quite a few different types of films now. This is her first big budget action film. And, you know, I think she holds her own. I think it doesn't really quite rise to the level of a lot of other action film directors. But I think for a first outing, it's solid. So, you know, I think she might get the chance to do another one.
Yeah, they left it open, and I think it's popular enough. I think we will see a sequel because, yeah, it's one of those that just say, you know, it's ready for chapter two. I can't guarantee there'll be a sequel, but I really think there will be one.
One of the things I found most bizarre about it, though, is it was rated R. And I kept trying to think back to what made it more R-ish than some of these PG-13 films that we see. And
there's a lot of blood.
A lot of violence. There's a lot of violence, but it's not like really graphic over the top that we've seen in a lot of other films. So, I mean, I would call it more like a PG-13 plus. I don't think it would be all that harmful for the older teens to watch this one. And, you know, it just, because I do think it's a introduction and a setup to this other, to a franchise. And so you sort of can see where these characters could potentially go in the future, being immortal and all. And so I liked it. I liked it. It wasn't, my most anticipated for superhero movies was going to be Wonder Woman 1984. And we're probably, it's going to be a while. And so I think this is about as close as you're going to get until that movie rolls around.
Well, that is not the only mass appeal release from Netflix this week. There's also a documentary, Mucho Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado. Now, I remember Dionne Warwick's commercials for the Psychic Friends Network, and she'd list off all of these famous people, and I was so young, but like, who are these people? They're not famous. But in college, I remember Miss Cleo, Call Me Now. I loved her commercials. She was so fun to watch. But this is about another astrologist, another television radio astrologist, and his name was Walter Mercado, and he was from Puerto Rico. And I guess he had 120 million Latino viewers. I had never heard of Walter Mercado. Talk about a blind spot. This guy is beloved. When I mentioned online that I had watched his film, I had people coming out of the woodwork going, oh, I love Walter. I'm like, how did I not know Walter? Well, it's because I didn't grow up either in Latin America nor in a Hispanic community in the United States. So I didn't see him. I didn't know who he was. But now that I know who he was, I find him peculiar. I find him riveting. I do want to pay attention to him. He has presence. If he was reading my Leo horoscope, I would listen to my Leo horoscope because I guarantee you I would get the good news. Did you feel the good news, Hannah?
I sometimes felt the good news, and then other times I was just so overwhelmed with how bizarre his character was. I don't remember. Again, I remember Dionne Warwick from the Psychic Friends Network. The part that got me was when he really was talking about how he really truly, when he helped create this network, thought these people were all legit. And I think he was somewhat disappointed to discover that perhaps some people were more in it for the money than for the positivity that that he seems to embody. So, I mean, yeah, I was not aware that he was this huge icon. He's this very gender nonconforming astrologer. So he makes no, he refuses to identify himself in any particular way, but he obviously is wearing makeup at times. He's sort of, his wardrobe is very eccentric, reminded me a lot of how like Liberace dressed in his time. And, this guy is, yeah, he just oozes positivity, and he's a rock star in the Latin community. And I guess he died in 2019, really just as he was kind of making a bit of a resurgence in terms of being popular online and stuff. And part of that is due to Lin-Manuel Miranda. And so he's featured in this documentary at a time where he met with Mercado, and Mercado was an idol of Lin-Manuel Miranda and his father. And Miranda's like brought to tears meeting this guy, and you're just sort of blown away at the influence and the memories that that this guy had on people like Lin-Manuel. And and he talks about how he would watch Mercado on TV with his grandmother in Puerto Rico growing up. And so it definitely, I think, is a documentary that is going to appeal most to those who are already familiar to some degree with this guy, or who maybe are into astrology and just getting that that sense of positivity. The guy talked about, even though he died last year at the age of 87, he may be back because he believed in reincarnation. And so, you know, if anybody kind of comes across anybody that's like Walter Mercado ever again, it could very well be the spirit of Mercado back to spread his message of, what's his message, Charlie?
I believe it's amor. And that
it's not just amor, it's mucho, mucho, mucho amor.
Ah, see, I think you were more affected by this film than you let on. That is why he got away with being non-gender conforming in a very gender-defined culture. They liked what he had to say. He made them feel positive, and he gave them something to look forward to. I had mad problems, though, with this film. Once we caught up from the past, I liked everything about the past, learning about where he was born, what his childhood was like, how he got on television, and his years on television. That works. Everything after that, everything what I'll call the present, it lost its mojo. Man, it just started to drag so much. I was getting so bored. There's a party at the end, and that it just felt like an hour. One of the co-directors, we've seen her work recently, Christina Constantini. We saw her in 2018, if you remember. You really enjoyed Science Fair. You remember Science Fair with those kids? Yeah. So that was her, and she's back now with a co-director, Kareem Tapsch. Mucho Mucho Amor, I think it's a mainstream documentary. You know, if you don't know who Walter is, I think you will enjoy learning who Walter is for the first 50% of the film.
Yeah, I agree. I made a note that I did feel that it ended several times. Like Mercado, it just kept going on. And I was like, okay, what's happening here? But I think what the reason for that ultimately probably was just the timing, that they were trying to tack on the fact that that this museum in Florida was doing a tribute exhibit to Mercado that he and his friends all were able to attend. And so because he died, you know, relatively soon thereafter, I think they felt that they had to push all of this other stuff into the documentary, and it took it in a different direction. And so it you're right, it lost its mojo. And I did not particularly like, you know, I did feel that the second part dragged way more, because the first part, you're just sort of sitting there watching somewhat in awe, trying to figure out who exactly he was and why people were so obsessed with him. And he pretty much was not very popular, I guess, on the talk show circuit. And, you know, anyone who watched Telemundo and, you know, or Univision type programming would have seen Walter Mercado. But, then by the second half, yes, I agree. You just kind of lost that that immersion factor and the crazy, the bizarreness of the beginning. And then it did take a turn. So I'm not sure it's all that mainstream. I think if you're on, you know, when it pops up on Netflix, is trending, and you're curious, it's worth kind of taking a look. Literally out of curiosity more than anything. But whether or not it's, you know, it's going to strike a chord with a broad audience, I don't know. Because it is, although then, hey, you look at how popular Tiger King became. And, you know, maybe this will be another opportunity for character-driven realization for people, you know, that you might not have noticed before or heard about before. So, you know, but I do love that everybody, everywhere he went, it was just mucho, mucho amor. And so I think if we all go around just saying mucho, 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 mucho amor, then the legend of Walter Mercado will live on.
All right, let's play a game. I am going to read you a log line. A, I want you to guess the film. And B, I want you to tell me whether or not what I'm saying about this film is true. Like, say, you know, you could say, "What you got it all wrong, Charlie." Or no, that's a good description. So here's the log line. A horny teenager falls in love with the first girl he sees and then pesters Sigmund Freud on how to pick up chicks. Am I, so A, what is the film?
I believe the film is the lovely World War II era drama, The Tobacconist.
Did I describe that correctly?
Sadly, I would say in some respects, that's certainly one of the plot points. Yes, definitely one of those films that's a yet another coming of age movie that gives you a mix of, I'd say, history for real and a lot of imagination. So, I don't know. What did you think of The Tobacconist?
I hated The Tobacconist. In German, Der Trafikant. It's a terrible film. We're in Vienna in 1937. That means things are about to get bad. We're on the eve of what is known as the Anschluss, the annexation of Austria by Deutschland. And Sigmund Freud's still in town. He hasn't packed up and left yet. And there's a new boy in town from the countryside. His mom sends him from the countryside to go learn a trade in the big bad city, and he becomes a tobacconist. He learns how to sell cigars and nudie magazines and postcards, and he falls in love with this girl. She's obviously a prostitute. He has no idea she is, but he can see he's very jealous of that, but he doesn't understand that people got to make money. Apparently this is based on a very successful novel. Never heard of it. It's got your boy, though. It's got Bruno Ganz. Bruno Ganz plays Sigmund Freud. Most people in America know him from Downfall, where he played Hitler. He actually died last year, by the way. Not Hitler, but Bruno Ganz. But you know him from your favorite movie from last year, A Hidden Life.
Yes, no, I know. I did see that when I looked up his biography. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. I was not a fan of A Hidden Life. But there were times in this film that I was kind of reminded of that one. So there was a bit of an irony there. Although I think he played, I think his role as Sigmund Freud was somewhat entertaining to watch. The guy who played Franz, though, the teenager, Simon Morse, he reminded me of like an Ansel Elgort type. That's what I kept saying when watching him. It's weird. It's just a weird movie. And so you've got, it was sort of like if you sort of took Jojo Rabbit, like as a 17-year-old instead of a 10-year-old, and you replaced, a positive character role with, with Dr. Freud instead of Jojo Rabbit's, imaginary Hitler, you kind of have a little bit of what you get in The Tobacconist. But I didn't know what it wanted to be, because you certainly have seen the same kind of story before, in terms of, being on the eve of Hitler's takeover of Austria, hello, Sound of Music, and anti-Semitism is on the rise. And so it's giving you all of that history. And I did think the setting, the scenery of the recreation of 1930s Vienna was very impressive in this film. But the story itself and the imaginary, the stuff with the kids' dreams, and it just got weird. And so it kept veering from somewhat interesting character development with the tobacconist that was his sort of mentor in Austria, in addition to Sigmund Freud. It veered from kind of really interesting story to then just really bizarre stuff that I wasn't quite sure where they were trying to go. And I kept thinking is every time Sigmund Freud walked into the shop, I kept thinking, sometimes a cigar is more than just a cigar. And he never says that to the kid, and maybe he should have.
Recall how awkward we all felt when Ansel Elgort and Shailene Woodley made out in Anne Frank's Amsterdam Attic. This film is 2 hours of that awkward feeling. Did you see the movie poster for this film? It makes it look like a rom-com. The girls all smile, and there's Sigmund Freud in the back, and there's the boy in the tobacconist kind of chuckling on the bench. I'm like, this is not a rom-com. This movie's not funny. What a terrible, misleading poster.
Yeah, because it's not funny at all, and I couldn't even begin to tell you how they would even how that could even come across on the poster. I think that's very flawed. Because you don't want to mislead people, because that's not the kind of film you're getting. You're just getting a very bizarre a weird kind of world, 1930s Austria film, and I'd much rather rewatch Sound of Music a few hundred times.
Speaking of not funny, let's use Lloyd Christmas's great joke from Dumb and Dumber. Austria! Ah, good day, mate. Let's jump to Australia and talk about Never Too Late. This is about old men, seniors, wanting to break out of a nursing home. They've broken out of things before. They're known as the Chain Breakers. They were in Vietnam together, which is a patchwork story. You have an American, a Brit, and two Aussies, and we were, I guess, fighting alongside each other in Vietnam. They broke out of, I guess, what sounds like the Hanoi Hilton together. Now, they didn't plan this. They all haphazardly, randomly wind up in the same nursing home in Australia. And even the head administrator has a connection to them as well. This movie is terrible. It might even be worse than The Tobacconist. We've got James Cromwell, we've got Jackie Weaver, and a bunch of nonsense, Hannah.
Which is a shame, because I generally like James Cromwell, and I definitely like Jackie Weaver, but she's not in it enough to really make her save it. It was certainly not nearly as good as, if you remember, did you ever see that one? It was the 100-year-old man who climbed out the window and disappeared. Mm. He sort of broke out of a nursing home, I think it was. And so that was, I remember seeing that one a while back, and I think that's probably your better nursing home breakout film. This one was promised another one where they lead you to believe you're about to watch a comedy, and it's not. It's just not. And that was a shame, because I was in the mood for a comedy, and that's why I started watching it. And I was disappointed, because it really was just, it was just kind of sad to me, ultimately, just a sad watch. And you have these guys who are trying to take one last shot at fulfilling something that they wanted to do in life. And so breaking out of this nursing home for veterans and sort of taking their last stand out in the world. It had moments that I thought were very sweet and poignant, but I did not like the story with the administrator, like what her connection turns out to be. And so it just seemed like it was quite a stretch to connect all these dots. And so it just never quite came together for me. And it was the world's slowest escape movie, I think. It took the longest time to break out. I'm like, when are we going to actually get them out into the rest of the world? And it took quite a long time.
Well, old people move slow. It takes them a while to get anywhere. It felt like it was edited like a TV episode, directed by Mark Lamprell. His major credit is he wrote Babe, Pig in the City.
James Cromwell.
You know, you said it's quite a stretch. It's way more than that. It's just ludicrous. This story is ludicrous. I'm going to say that's my word for the podcast. It's ludicrous.
Yeah, they try to spin it as a cross between Grumpy Old Men and The Great Escape, and it just isn't.
It's neither. It's neither.
It's neither. So, yeah, I wouldn't recommend anyone run out and try and find that one.
All right, well, I watched a film you didn't this week, because I watched it and then I quickly texted you, Hannah, this is not for you. Do not watch this movie. It's called We Are Little Zombies. No, it is not a horror movie. There are no actual zombies. It's from Japan. It actually has a lot of festival buzz. It won an award at the Berlin Film Festival and this year's Sundance from director Nagahisa Makoto. It's about four orphans. All of their parents just died. None of them can shed a tear. I don't know if they're in shock or they're just stoic. They're not particularly sad about it. So we learn all of their respective backstories, and then they fall backwards into this like viral music video, and they become Japanese music sensations as they're on this journey of somewhat of an emotional rescue. And they talk in these philosophical platitudes. It reminded me of Zach Braff in Garden State. Listen to the kid's opening monologue. Today, Mommy turned to dust. So did Daddy. Like dusty,
ooh, deep.
Like dusty as Parmesan on a plate of bolognese. They feel like zombies. They're not crying. Little Kate, I'm going to bring it full circle to last week, Hannah. You're going to love this. Little Keita Ninomiya. He plays the main kid. He was in 2013's Like Father, Like Son, a wonderful film about babies getting switched at birth and then people finding out later when they're like 8 years old. You know who that was directed by, Hannah? That was directed by Hirokazu Korida.
Yeah, and you pronounced it well. Our friend Christian Hammaker will be very happy with that.
We Are Little Zombies is crazy. It's frenetic. It's experimental. The camera is nuts. It's inside a chip bag. It's inside an orange juice glass. This could become one of those midnight cult classics.
Okay, I will take your word for that, because all I needed was the title to know that I just really had no interest in watching some movie about a bunch of kids that were devoid of all emotion. I'm just like, you know, I don't want to see anything quite that somber right now, although it sounds like it's not necessarily. When they start singing, does it pick up? Is
it does.
That how it works?
It's not that somber. It's really not. I watched it because nothing else looks like this movie. This movie is really original. It's very innovative. It has some great ideas. I don't think it carries it all the way through. I started to wander during the last 20% of it or so. But I want to see more from this guy. I think he's got a future. He's really out there, and out there in mostly a good way.
Well, I'm glad you found something that was out there enough for you to grasp this week. You know, I'll just make quick mention too, the one that we did not watch that is out this week is the new Tom Hanks movie. We didn't get a preview of it, but it is, you know, it is out now. I think it's on Apple Plus. And yeah, that's one where I kind of wanted to see it, but then it was not getting all that much real buzz. And it was another World War II movie with Tom Hanks playing a captain at sea. And so it's a labor of love for him. Like, it was a movie that he just, you know, put his star power behind. But I'm talking about Greyhound. And so I'm not sure if anyone sees it. Let us know what you think. Maybe we'll get around to watching it. I do have Apple TV, but it seems to be one of those types of films that maybe won't translate quite so well onto the small screen, that might have needed to be a big screen release. But, you know, it's Tom Hanks, so you got to figure that it will pick up some Tom Hanks fans, just because Tom Hanks is the original Mr. Nice Guy, and you kind of want to support him no matter what. And so, you know, we'll have to see if Greyhound picks up steam.
Yeah, I'll catch up with it in the future. I think the Old Guard has more online buzz right now, though. I think it's the bigger film. I don't know if that's because more people have Netflix than Apple TV. It's a possibility. But
I think people want to see a superhero type movie over yet another World War II. You know, drama. I just think we're sort of over that. And so if you have a chance to see Charlize Theron kicking butt, it's going to be more fun than watching Tom Hanks as captain at sea.
But we're just guessing. We don't know for sure.
We don't know. We will see, won't we? So anyway, on that note, I think that's going to do it for us. Do you have anything more to add, Charlie?
It's weird, but I think The Old Guard is the best film of the week.
I agree. I do think that if I had to direct people to one of these films, The Old Guard is going to be it, because it's just it's decent escapism, and that's what we all want right now. So that will do it, I believe, for us. Quick programming note, however, we're going to take a bye week next week, because there really isn't all that much coming out next week. So all of our listeners can use that time to catch up on past episodes. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening to The Cinema Clash. Stay safe, wash your hands, and please just wear a mask.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend, at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.